From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The 115th Congress is in full swing and getting ready to hold hearings on Donald Trump's cabinet nominees. Those start tomorrow. Tomorrow evening, President Obama will give his farewell address from McCormick Place in Chicago. That's the same place he held his 2012 re-election victory party. And then Wednesday, more hearings and a press conference from President-elect Trump. If that happens, it would be the first one in 165 days by NPR's count. Joining us now is NPR politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hi there.
And let's start with tomorrow's hearings. Trump's pick for Attorney General Jeff Sessions is up first in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. That's at 9:30 in the morning Eastern time. And there are allegations that he once used racist language that ended his bid to become a federal judge 30 years ago. Remind us about those allegations. And do you think that those are likely to be front and center tomorrow?
I think that'll definitely be part of it from Democrats. You've heard civil rights activists as well as legal groups come forward. Deville Patrick, for example, who was the former governor of Massachusetts, who wrote a letter to the Judiciary Committee noting that when he was a civil rights lawyer on the other side of Jeff Sessions, that that he felt that he was discriminatory in pursuing a case against civil rights against folks who are trying to help others vote. So this was a voter assistance case. It was basically thrown out of court. And but you had Sessions, Patrick complained, did not go after, let's say, whites who went through with voter assistance. During that hearing in 1986, which was the first time in half a century that someone up for a federal judgeship had been voted down, he had joked that that the KKK was okay until he learned that they were pot smokers. That a white civil rights lawyer was a quote disgrace to his race, something that he later denied. Now he wound up getting his revenge. He didn't get the judgeship, but he got a seat in the Senate.
And of course, we're going to be watching that hearing tomorrow. But then on Wednesday, we have Secretary of State nominee Rex Tillerson testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at 9:15 a.m. Eastern. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is up there later that morning. What are you going to be watching for there?
Well, it's just a busy and consequential week, quite honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, Rex Tillerson is the thing that I think a lot of people are watching, given what Donald Trump has said about Russia over the past week, the fact that still, even after his meeting Friday with intelligence officials, that Trump has not come forward strongly to say that he believes that Russia did hack the DNC and that they were trying to affect the outcome of the election. Instead, it's been very defensive and being able to try to say, you know, that didn't affect the outcome of the election.
Right.
But I think the Tillerson hearing is going to be a proxy fight for this Russia stuff, because Tillerson himself was awarded an order of friendship by the Russian President Vladimir Putin when Tillerson was in charge of ExxonMobil. And he'll say that that was just part of a business relationship, but certainly senators on both sides are going to want to dig in on that.
And all of this is happening as Trump prepares to hold this press conference on Wednesday, right as some of these nominees will be up on Capitol Hill. Is this a strategy of just trying to put it all out there at the same time so people can't focus too much on one thing?
Yeah, I think that that's a big part of it. You know, that's the Trump sort of chaos theory of politics. I mean, he likes to step right into the middle of it, create things that go in all different directions, sort of a shotgun of news. And, you know, whether it's tweets, even today, you know, he was asked when he came downstairs from Trump Tower after meeting with Jack Ma, who runs Alibaba, that, you know, whether or not he trusts Julian Assange or United States Intelligence more. He said, we'll talk about that on Wednesday. He said, how will you disentangle yourself from your business conflicts? We'll talk about that on Wednesday. You know, what about Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, whether he'd be in the White House? We'll talk about that on Wednesday. Would there be a replacement bill for Obamacare ready when it was repealed? We'll talk about that on Wednesday. So there's a lot to talk about on Wednesday.
And the one thing he did talk about this morning on Twitter is what a lot of people have been talking about, which was Meryl Streep's speech at the Golden Globes last night. Let's listen here to a little bit. This is her most emotional moment. It came when she was talking about Trump mocking a New York Times reporter's disability back in November 2015.
It was that moment when the person asking to sit in the most respected seat in our country imitated a disabled reporter, someone he outranked in privilege, power, and the capacity to fight back. It kind of broke my heart when I saw it, and I still can't get it out of my head because it wasn't in a movie. It was real life. Disrespect invites disrespect. Violence incites violence. When the powerful use their position to bully others, we all lose.
Now, Trump has repeatedly denied that he made fun of the reporter's disabilities. But what do you make of this?
Right. And Trump says that he was showing how the reporter was groveling. But, you know, I have to say, this was one of those moments that even when you showed Trump supporters video of what Trump was doing in making fun of that reporter, that was the worst moment for him throughout this campaign. And it's clearly still under his skin. Of course, when it comes to Meryl Streep, she's being Meryl Streep and being Hollywood and was a strong Clinton supporter and certainly having a very difficult time with the result of the election.
That's NPR Politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, a lot going on this week. We'll be talking to you. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.
Well, Kaiser Permanente is a giant in the healthcare field. It's the largest managed care group in the country, operating in 11 states, including California. So it can be a big deal when a company that size begins to invest in renewables and other green measures like energy efficiency and saving water. That's what's happening in Colorado, but there are plenty of questions about whether other big businesses will follow. From Here and Now contributor Colorado Public Radio, John Daly reports.
Adam Carew stands in a parking lot outside his office with a cable in his hand. He plugs it in, and his electric car starts to charge.
Obviously, by me driving this car, I'm a big proponent of renewable energy.
This charging station sits in the parking lot of Kaiser Permanente's Lone Tree Medical offices. Carew is a family physician here. As a KP employee, he can plug his car in for free anytime.
I think it's great that Kaiser's investing in that because I think it's clearly the future.
Kaiser's leaders agree. The nonprofit health system has made it a priority to go green. Roland Lyon is regional president of the Kaiser Foundation Health Plan.
Environmental health and the impact that has on the health of a community are so tightly correlated.
Kaiser's environmental investments include new buildings that have won awards for energy efficiency. It's also investing in waste reduction and water conservation. Lyon says research shows environmental factors like air pollution have twice the impact on people's health than access to high-quality medicine. And he says these green measures save money.
So having a healthy environment which supports healthy living really improves our mission and our bottom line.
You notice they're sort of arrayed towards the south to get the southern exposure.
Clayton Mitchell points to a covered parking lot topped with solar panels. Mitchell heads up Kaiser's investments in renewables in Colorado. In a state with 300 sunny days a year, he says these solar panels provide more than half the electric energy needed to power the adjacent medical office building.
55%. Over 25 years, we anticipate getting $160,000 in energy savings.
Kaiser has installed solar systems at seven Colorado facilities through what's called a power purchase agreement. It's a deal between KP, solar developer Namaste, and XL Energy. Mitchell says the partnership lets Kaiser lock in low energy rates for the next 20 years.
Which makes it very affordable, drops our operating costs, and those savings can be passed on to our members.
KP is one of a growing number of brands like Walmart, Target, Google, and Apple investing in renewable energy. Rebecca Cantwell leads Colorado Solar Energy Trade Association. She says they're doing it because of the health benefits and the bottom line.
I don't think any large corporation makes decisions that don't pencil out for them economically.
Cantwell says as solar has caught on globally, the price of panels has plummeted by more than 50% in a decade.
What's really happened with the price of solar is dramatic.
Government policy played a big role, too. Solar and wind took off in Colorado after its voters became the first to pass a renewable energy standard in 2004. The state is required to get 30% of its electricity from renewables by 2020. Aaron Overturf with the group Western Resource Advocates says demand from business like Kaiser is growing.
I would describe it as flourishing and untapped.
But solar represents just 1.5% of Colorado's electricity mix. And some wonder if demand for renewables will drop if the new Trump administration cracks back on tax credits, credits that jump-started the industry. Congresswoman Diana DeGette, a Denver Democrat, fears the answer is yes.
I think we're going to see a big assault on this.
Officials at Kaiser Permanente say they intend to keep investing in green initiatives, but many eyes will turn to Washington to see how a new administration will shape energy policy and how that will influence business decisions on whether to go green. For Here and Now, I'm John Daly in Denver.
Prosecutors in Pennsylvania are slowly working through hundreds of cases of people sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for crimes they committed as juveniles who are now entitled to resentencing hearings. Philadelphia is home to the highest number of juvenile lifers in Pennsylvania and in the whole country. Some 300 people sentenced as kids are serving life sentences without the possibility of parole. That's because for years that was a mandatory sentence in Pennsylvania for juveniles convicted of murder or felony murder, committing certain felonies during which a death occurs. That's what happened to Robert Holbrook. We want to revisit his story. We first brought it to you this summer.
Hi. Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you, too.
This is Robert's sister, Anita Cologne. We visited her in her lovely home outside Philly, where she showed us pictures of her younger brother.
This is in first grade, and that's his first Holy Communion. And this is my mom, and that's him with my mom.
In 1990, on Robert's 16th birthday, some older men, drug dealers, offered him $500 to be the lookout on what was supposed to be a drug deal. But the wife of a rival drug dealer was killed, and even though Robert didn't witness it, under Pennsylvania law, he got life. For the last 26 years, all the family pictures are during prison visits.
My youngest daughter, Nadia, who, to give some perspective, is 20 now. He's been in prison for her entire life, and she's about, was almost three there on a visit that we were, you know, visiting.
But now several recent court decisions mean that Robert will get a chance at resentencing. We sat down to ask Anita about the potential of resentencing, but also about that day 26 years ago when her brother was sentenced.
Yeah, I remember it very, very well. Even though, I mean, I'm sure at some point we were told that there was a possibility that he could be given this sentence, I remember, you know, the shock and just the devastation. My stepfather kept asking the attorney, well, life, all right, well, what does that mean? How many years? And I can remember it, and he was just like, you know, it's life. And he's like, yeah, but how many years? 25, 20? Because a life sentence, you know, was not your natural life and still is not in many of our neighboring states. And so he just couldn't grasp that this was his entire life. That can't possibly be so. Like, he's a little kid. Like, how can that be?
Yeah. 26 years. Your mother, when she was alive, and your family, you've all got this invisible line to your brother. What's it been like to have a sibling in prison?
Life has never, ever been the same. Even, you know, 26 years later, it's not the same. In the early years, or, you know, the years when my mom was still here, everything, every day, every occasion was always shadowed by the fact that her son was in prison and probably for the rest of his life. You're thinking about how you wish Robert was here, and so it's sadness and it's guilt, and so much guilt that, you know, what could you, should you have done more? Like, should I have, like, locked him in his room? Should I have told my mother, lock him in the basement? Like, you know, you absolutely go through that. And as I watched my mom suffer and the sadness and just try to, you know, appeal to legislators, to human rights groups. There really was no one advocating about, you know, this issue. It wasn't, you know, considered an issue. And I supported my brother and knew this was a really horrible thing that happened, but it wasn't until years later that I kind of realized that this wasn't just some anomaly, that this was something that was happening, you know, all over this country. So then, you know, I became an activist, and at the same time, I had a son that was growing up. And when my son turned 16 years old, it was a really emotional day, you know, as happy as I was for him. It was just thinking, I'm sorry,
it's okay.
Thinking about looking at him. And it was just a reminder again that, you know, he was just this child. And it was like that my brother had, you know, at the age of 16, had gone to prison, an adult prison. And it tore me apart. And at the same time, there would be this relief every birthday, everything that my son did. You know, my son got his first driver's license, and it was a happy day. And I think about that my brother never had an opportunity to get a driver's license, you know. And he went to the prom, and I'd feel so sad that he hadn't gotten to go to a prom. We go to visit him, even after all these years, when it's time to leave, and you know, he's got to go back out one door and we're going out another. I have to go to the ladies' room, and if I'm with my kids and I don't want them to be upset or myself, or I sit in my car and I cry. My mother wrote to my brother literally every day from the time he was incarcerated until she no longer could, like months before her death.
I'm hearing that you feel an obligation almost for your mother to keep up your
Absolutely.
Connection with him.
I mean, I love my brother, so without a doubt I wouldn't have forgotten about him. However, I promised my mother on her deathbed, and that's, you know, not to be dramatic, it's very true, that he would never be forgotten, that we would visit him, we would write to him, that he would know his family, and that I would fight and do whatever I could to bring him home. And those were the two things I promised her.
We should note here that during our entire conversation, Anita wipes away tears almost by habit. Well, we come to the recent court decisions. In 2012, in Miller v. Alabama, the Supreme Court ruled that mandatory life sentences without the possibility of parole for juveniles is unconstitutional. Many states fought making that decision retroactive. Then this year, in Montgomery v. Louisiana, the Supreme Court ruled again, this time that its 2012 decision was retroactive, and now Robert is eligible for resentencing. Do you find yourself thinking, oh my, this could, one of the possibilities is he could come home?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is something that has been sort of like a roller coaster, because when the Miller decision came out, I cried, you know, just tears of relief and joy. And I remember calling my my oldest daughter to tell her, and I was happy, but, you know, when she answered the phone, I couldn't talk, because I was just, you know, so emotional. And she could hear I was crying, and I was trying to get the words out. And she's like, what's wrong, Mom? What's wrong? And I was like, it's nothing. It's not bad. It's good, you know? It was just like, finally, you know, finally. We've been fighting for so long. And then not long after, Pennsylvania decided it wasn't retroactive, and it was just devastating.
What would you say to people who say, look, I don't care if he's 16. If somebody offers you $500 to do something that you know is wrong, you know, there's a law that says that even if you're tangentially involved and there's a murder, drug handoffs and drug disputes often end in murders. You should have known. I can hear people saying this, that this is the consequences.
So what I would say, first of all, is that you can't in any way compare what an adult should have known to a child. And that is the basis of all these Supreme Court decisions, that kids are different. We spend so much time as a society, and we're so concerned with how to protect children because we know they can't make decisions for themselves in every other aspect other than if they commit a crime. So all these ways, and, you know, joining the military, to get married, all of these things, we protect our youth and say, you're not mature enough to make this decision, you know, or to do this. So we need to take care of you.
Well, the other thing, again, to underscore, we've been talking about his age and the impact on your family, but he did not commit the murder.
Absolutely. I mean, my brother, without a doubt, deserved to be punished for what he did. Obviously, when there's a case, especially if there's a homicide or a death, you know, and there's a victim, the victim's family suffers and everyone, you know, realizes that. And I don't take away from that at all, you know, the suffering. Had there not been a death, had it been a drug deal and the cops would have swooped in, he would have been guilty of being involved in that. So at no point do we feel as if he should have just been able to walk away. But to take away his life, to tell him that at the age of 16, you know, when he hasn't even been able to finish high school, hasn't done anything, to say your life is worthless at this point and there is nothing you can offer society, is completely unjust and unfair.
Anita Colon talking about her brother Robert Holbrook, who was sentenced at 16 to life in prison without the possibility of parole for being the lookout on a drug deal in which others committed a murder. We spoke last summer, and as we said, his case and others are being reviewed after a Supreme Court declared these mandatory sentences unconstitutional. Robert and others are appealing for hearings that would be resentencing hearings. We'll keep you posted, and we welcome your thoughts at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/here. Go now and get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
The women's clothing store The Limited closed its 250 stores over the weekend. The company says the move cost about 4,000 jobs, and it comes amid some other bad news for retailers Macy's and Sears. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her new podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So The Limited says it's going to keep selling clothes online. But what happened to this company and what's it hoping for now?
Well, the company actually attributed falling foot traffic at malls to the problems. But let's be honest, they absolutely suffered from not keeping up with the trends. I think that, frankly, this is not just a problem about online shopping, but this particular brand really did not stay focused on what was relevant to what's going on right now in fashion. And they were a little bit more expensive than a lot of the than their customers would have liked.
And this comes after Macy's said last week that it would close nearly 70 of its stores and cut 10,000 jobs. What's going on with Macy's?
Well, Macy's, obviously, big department store chain, came out and said that their sales, their comparable sales from a year ago in November and December, were down by 2.1%. Now, here's the thing. It made a promise to its shareholders way back last summer and said, we're going to focus on the best performing locations, and we're going to look at our website and try to beef that up. So I think that once these sales came up short, now they say we're going to close a bunch of stores, we're going to use the money we save, we're going to bolster our digital presence, and we're going to focus on some things that are working. Their backstage discount or off-price stores, which seem to be doing quite well. And they also have a fast-growing element called Blue Mercury. These are beauty shops that compete directly with Sephora. So they're going to basically say, let's focus on what's doing really well and let's get rid of what's not doing well at all.
And what about Sears, which announced it would close 150 stores and it is selling off its Craftsman tool brand?
Sears is a little bit different, okay, because they have had some serious financial issues that have been plaguing them. You may remember a guy named Edward Lampert, or Lampere, if you're French. And this is a guy who's really a private equity investor, and he has come in to run this organization. And frankly, what has happened is it's been bleeding cash. They've announced that they were going to close 150 stores, but they've also got a big problem because they're relying on him to actually beef up their financial aspect. And, you know, he's got another side to his business, which is he's got a presence in the real estate business. So right now we know that he's got access. He's given them, meaning he's giving Sears, $500 million in secured loans. And they're going to try to invest heavily in the company and to close these various locations that aren't working and really try to focus on, again, what is working. But I think that the financial pressure on Sears is different than almost any other retailer. This is one that when I talk to a retail analyst, they'll say, this is the one we think actually may not make it this year.
And just briefly, Jill, is there a broader retail story here?
Yeah, I mean, we've got too much retail space relative to the way that we shop right now. And frankly, any retailer that doesn't have both the digital strategy and a brick and mortar strategy that can be fast and adapt to the customer preferences is one that's going to fall short. So keep an eye out. Retail sales out this Friday. It may be good for some, but not so good for others.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money and her new podcast, Better Off. Jill, thanks.
Take care.
In December, 55 scientists from 18 countries set off from South Africa for a three-month voyage around Antarctica. The Swiss Polar Institute is the lead sponsor of the Antarctic Circumnavigation Expedition, which will return to port in March. And it's a voyage that comes at a critical time for Antarctica. Just last week, new data showed a rift in West Antarctica's Larsen C ice shelf was about to cleave off an iceberg the size of Delaware. David Walton is the expedition's chief scientist. He's with the British Antarctic Survey, and we've reached him by phone in a remote part of the southern Indian Ocean. David, where are you?
Well, we're just south of a big island called Kerguelen, which has a French research station on it, and we're hoping to see them probably early tomorrow morning when we'll start landing field parties to collect samples on the island. So we're looking outside at the moment into really quite sunny weather, and just outside the window I can see three or four wandering albatrosses swooping across the top of the waves at the moment. It's a beautiful sight.
Well, we understand these are part of a group of islands in the southern Indian Ocean known as the Desolation Islands. It is pretty desolate?
Well, yes. I mean, I think for me it's a bit like the islands off the coast of Scotland. There's no trees, there's brown vegetation and rock extending into the distance. Maybe it's like some parts of Labrador and Newfoundland and places like that. But it's got its own beauty. And on a nice day like this, when the sun's shining, it really is magical.
Yeah, and we understand this is the first expedition of some of these little-known islands. You know, your goal is Antarctica. We'll talk about that. But what do you expect to find from these islands?
Well, what we're trying to do, which is why the expedition was conceived in the first place, is we're trying to understand the role that the islands, the sub-Antarctic islands like Kerguelen, Crozet, Marion Island, Heard Island, and so on, that surround the Antarctic, what role do they play in the Southern Ocean itself? What nutrients do they give to the ocean? How do their bird and seal populations relate to the seas around them? And how do those seas change in a world where global change is driving everything in a particular direction? So what we're trying to do in one summer is go all the way around the Antarctic, taking samples, taking measurements, bringing together a lot of different disciplines in an attempt to improve our understanding in a major leap rather than in small bits.
Well, and the statement that the expedition released said a better understanding of Antarctica is critical not just for its preservation, but for the whole planet. Remind us why.
Well, because Antarctica is an enormous continent, and it actually is basically an important part of the way in which the world climate works. Without Antarctica, the system wouldn't work like it does. Without the Southern Ocean around it, the carbon dioxide we produce would stay in the atmosphere rather than be sucked into the sea and locked away in rocks in future eons. So the Antarctic and its surrounding sea influences not only what we can see around us, but also everything worldwide. The Southern Ocean drives the currents up into the North Atlantic and into the Indian Ocean, and the melting of parts of the Antarctic, especially the West Antarctic area, or where the peninsula is threatening to precipitate a significant amount of extra water into the oceans, which inevitably will result in rising sea levels. Mm. So it matters to everybody.
Well, in March, David Pollard, a researcher at Pennsylvania State University, co-authored that study that said climate change could melt the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is bigger than Mexico, you know, huge,
much sooner than expected. You would agree with that?
Well, some of the recent evidence has suggested that the areas that we thought were potentially stable ice are being melted underneath by warmer water as they flow out onto the sea. And so they're melting both at the top and they're melting at the bottom. And when you remove the ice from the edge of the Antarctic, then the ice inside the Antarctic flows more quickly to the sea. And so suddenly you have more ice coming into the sea and therefore greater potential for a change in sea level. So, it is based on models, and therefore we have to have uncertainty in our judgments here. But it does look, from everything I've seen over the past 50 years, as though global change is certainly making a massive difference to West Antarctica.
Well, and what about East Antarctica? Do I understand this is, you know, two-thirds of the ice on the continent of Antarctica is in East Antarctica, and you are closer to East Antarctica now?
Yes, we will be visiting the East Antarctic ice sheet on the next leg of our journey down from Hobart to the continent. And there it's true, as far as we can tell at the moment, the majority of the ice on East Antarctica is pretty stable. It's not actually melting in any significant amount. It's a very large amount of ice, and so it really doesn't matter what happens to it. But when I say that it looks as though it's stable, then I have to make a caveat, and that is that it's a huge area and it's up to 4 kilometers thick. And so actually being able to measure relatively small changes, which would still make a difference to world sea level, is turning out to be a considerable technical problem. And so we have many people in different parts of the world trying to find better ways of ensuring that we can look at the stability of the East Antarctic ice sheet.
Well, so meanwhile, here you are headed for Antarctica to circumvent it. Antarctica, you know, has such a romance for so many people. I mean, the last landmass discovered on Earth, the most southernmost continent, it's got the South Pole, it's twice the size of Australia. What does it mean for you as a scientist to be in this region?
Oh, I've been doing this for 50 years. I think that speaks for itself. I believe the Antarctic is one of the most fascinating places in the world, and indeed so do the other people on board this ship. We're a microcosm of the way in which science works in Antarctica. 18 different countries brought together on a Russian ship, actually sailing around the Antarctic to improve its understanding for everyone. All keen to actually add their expertise to investigating different aspects of the seas and islands. I think that's a great objective. And with the Swiss bringing all this together, it's really, I think, going to be a very useful output for many of the scientists around the world, and in the end, for everybody in understanding the importance of Antarctica.
And what's one thing you will be looking for as you sail forward?
One of the things I'll be looking for, with our helicopters and our many measuring instruments, we actually do best when we've got good weather. So I'm praying for good weather, because that will enable us to get the maximum amount out of the expedition.
Yeah. David, can we check in with you as you continue your voyage?
By all means, check in with me. I'll be voyage for almost another 80 days.
Okay, it's a date. David Walton, chief scientist of the Antarctic Circumnavigation Expedition at the bottom of the world off the coast of Antarctica. As he says, just 80 days to go. So we will check back.
Well, now let's check in on one of the worst storms to hit California and Nevada in a decade. The region is experiencing major floods and mudslides. Hundreds of homes have been evacuated, and rain and snow are expected to continue through Thursday. Jay Familietti is a hydrologist and senior water scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He's on Skype. And first, tell us what it's like there in California right now.
It's quite varied across the state. Of course, up north, that region has been hit very hard. It's received over 4 inches of rain overnight, in some places up to 9 inches. And there's been a tremendous amount of flooding and rising rivers and other hazards. In the southern half of the state, you know, not so much. We get some heavy rain overnight, but it continues to be pretty dry here.
Have you seen a storm like this before in your career?
Oh, I certainly have. I've lived in some places that have experienced extreme precipitation as well as extreme drought. I used to live in Texas. But for California, This is a major storm for sure.
What does it mean for the ongoing drought in California?
In the short term, our reservoirs will be replenished. So that, of course, is great news. In the long term, you know, we need to have a few winters like this to really help us get out of our chronic water scarcity situation.
Even with a big storm like this, it's not enough to bring you back to where you need to be?
It's not enough for the long term. It's enough for the short term, but we use so much water here in California, in particular to grow food in the Central Valley, that it seems that we never have enough.
That's Jay Famiglietti of the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
As of this morning, the week-old 2nd Avenue subway line in New York is running 24 hours a day. There were more than 48,000 riders in the first day of operation, and about 200,000 people are expected to ride the line per day. Now, building the 2nd Avenue subway cost $4.5 billion for just three stations, which comes out to about $2.2 billion per mile. That makes it the most expensive subway project in the world. Joining us now is Nicole Gelinas, who is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, contributing editor of City Journal and a columnist at the New York Post. Nicole, welcome.
Thanks for having me in.
And why was the 2nd Avenue subway so expensive to build, especially compared to other subway systems around the world?
Well, there are good reasons and bad reasons why it's so expensive. The good reasons are we're never going back to the age where we built subways in 18 months. We built the Brooklyn Bridge quickly. We built the Empire State Building quickly. And that's because we've got environmental rules and laws, social rules and laws, so that, for example, they can't work all night and disturb the residents. They can't keep the street uncovered for years and years and not have any traffic go by. They've got to do this project in a very dense urban environment where people already live and work. And that automatically makes it more expensive. The bad reasons are we've got inefficient labor rules. These are hard jobs that require quite a lot of skill, but some of the work rules mean that the people who are being paid are not able to be as productive as they could be. And we also plan the projects and execute them poorly. Things like the management of the project, having multiple contractors working in one area. If one contract isn't done on time, the other contractors are being paid to wait around or to do inefficient work because they're all trying to work in a narrow space.
And so other countries don't have to deal with these kinds of things?
In countries like China, they simply don't have the safety rules, the environmental rules that we have. So I don't think that's a very good thing. But certainly you're right. In Western Europe, in France, in Spain, in Germany, yes, they have modern work rules. They have modern environmental rules. But they are able to do at least some of these projects more quickly. And part of that is because the infrastructure companies have to pay for the health care for the workers and the pensions for the workers. In Europe, these costs are not put on the cost of the project. These are nationally borne costs.
And that makes that much of a difference? I mean, when you think about the costs of building a subway in a major city, you don't really think that health care costs for the workers are going to be a big part of that.
Sure, because a project is 40% materials costs, and materials cost the same wherever you are, steel, cement, and so forth. 40% labor costs and then 20% overhead costs. And so if your labor costs are well above what they are in the rest of the world, then that makes a big, big difference. And by the way, when you go over your schedule, what are you paying for? You're paying for laborers to work more months, more years than they otherwise would have. And for example, on the productivity issues, if you have a tunnel boring machine here, the union rules require as many as 25 people to be operating the tunnel boring machine. In Europe, in a southern state, it could be 5 people to 9 people on the tunnel boring machine.
So do you see any way to cut through some of this red tape and some of these issues so that people who are advocating more public transit being built in this country as we go forward can actually get those things done and make them not prohibitively expensive?
Well, one thing that would help is doing contracts through design-build, where the same contractor is responsible for the design of the project and then the construction of the project. Because right now, you have the government awarding a design contract or multiple design contracts, multiple engineering contracts, and then multiple construction contracts. So if the design doesn't fit what's needed during actual construction, it's the government who ends up paying all of these extra costs.
But do you expect that things like that will be done and that there will be more public transit projects undertaken in the U.S.?
Well, there's a lot of inertia. It's a vicious cycle where the public sees that these things are always late, they're always billions of dollars over budget, and so they don't support more of them. But we certainly need to do the projects, and whether we do them well or we do them poorly, doing them poorly is better than not doing them at all. And unfortunately, that seems to be our real-world choice.
That's Nicole Gelinas, who's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor of City Journal and a columnist at the New York Post, joining us from New York. And Nicole, have you been on the Second Avenue subway line yet?
No, not yet. I'm planning to go over later this week.
All right. Well, good luck, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.